So last time we were discussing Twister space with these coordinates v1, v2, z. It's going to be related to space-time by... So, A, B, C, D, these parameters are a point in complexified space-time. And recall that we said, a point in complexified space-time gives a CP1 in Twister space. And the CP1 is given by these equations. So the kind of tricky and slightly subtle thing we were discussing last time was how do we make, how do we see real space-time instead of complexified space-time? And we figured out that we do this by imposing a reality condition. So we had a certain anti-holomorphic involution which said z to minus 1 over z bar and did something to the v's. And then on the a, b, c, d, which are the coordinates in space-time, it amounted to the following condition. So the condition was A equals D bar and C is minus B bar. So then the equations become so I can rewrite the simple equation in the following way. B2 bar is equal to minus b plus minus. Okay, so the reason I'm doing this is I want to give you a more geometric feeling for the relationship between Twister space and real space time. So far, this relationship is a little abstract and I imagine kind of confusing. Position. So there is an isomorphism diffeomorphism of real manifolds from R4 times CP1 to Twister space. And it's given by these expressions. So I want to parameterize R4 by two complex numbers, A and B. So it sends A, B, Z, gets sent to, well, on Twister space, it's parameterized by three complex numbers. So I take A plus BZ minus b bar plus a bar z and z.
So this map makes sense.
What are we saying?
I take a point in F1. There's a corresponding twister line. That's it. So I'm saying I take a point in the point of the twister line and I take a
corresponding point in twister space.
So the statement is saying that this is a diffeomorphism. What it means is that
every point here is on a unique twister line for a point in Euclidean space. So the content is every V1, V2, C is on a unique twister line for a point in Euclidean or 4.
What do we call a twister line? A point in CP1, simply?
Oh, sorry. Remember we said that each point in complexified space-time is associated to a CP1?
So that's called the twister line
associated to this point. Twister line. CP1 associated to okay.
So the first step for this
is going to show existence and uniqueness.
So uniqueness. Suppose I had a point in twister space which was on two different twister lines.
Then I would have two twister lines which intersect. And what does that mean? Null separated, exactly. And since it's Euclidean, that's not possible. So
that already tells me this is a very Euclidean phenomenon.
Symmetry.
Existence
so this means like given V1 V2 Z can we find A B solving the equations which I wrote down there. V1 equals A plus BZ. V2 bar is AZ bar minus B. Okay.
So, this is parallel equations on
B, the complex coefficients.
So, if I want to figure out, can I solve this equation? You can look at this matrix on here for the trend.
Debt 1 z z bar minus 1 is not equal to 0, where this determinant is equal to minus 1 minus z z bar, which is strictly negative. So we can always solve this equation.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Mm-hmm.
So it's now separated. It's again with respect to the inner product that we defined yesterday. And
yes.
Being the difference between the points with respect to that inner product is zero.
Yes.
And because we're in Euclidean space, the only point that corresponds to a zero norm, the zero inner product is the zero point.
Itself. Exactly. So they would, if they were null separated, then the 2 points in Euclidean space would actually be the same. And therefore, the two twister lines would be the same root.
Right, so if we've... So, like, there are two vectors in the twister space which are null separated, which means they're all in, but the distance between them is zero. Because it's in Euclidean space, the only vector on x0 was the 0 vector. And it must be the same vector. Okay, so this is... This picture of twister space has A4 times CP1 with a certain complex structure.
It's maybe the most geometric. Yeah.
I think maybe I'm not understanding well, like, the proposition, because, like, we are using the result that we proved yesterday about the correspondence, and the difference between yesterday and today is that this is a like yesterday we found a bijection, but this is a diffeomorphism, or yesterday it was a diffeomorphism too. Like,
so what we discussed yesterday was a CP1 in twister space corresponds to a point in complexified spacetime, and certain nice CP1s in twister space correspond to points at O4. So here we're having a stronger result, right? So that correspondence tells us that there's some kind of map. I take a point in O4, that'll give me a CP1. And then I take a coordinate, a point in that CP1, and I get a point in twister space. So it's not obvious that this map is a diffeomorphism, because I could have two different points in O4 where the corresponding CP1s intersect. And then I would have two points in here which would have the same image. If I was to do this in a Lorentzian signature, and I had two null-separated vectors, then the appropriate choice of points in CP1, they would actually land at the same point in twister space.
I have a question about dimension counting. So twister space globally, we yesterday thought of it as CP3 mod CP1.
Not mod with a CP1 removed.
Subtraction. Sets.
Subtraction of sets, yes.
Three complex dimensions.
Three complex dimensions, so six real dimensions, and same here.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm a bit confused by that proposition, because we're saying that the solution doesn't always exist, but I thought that...
We're saying it does always exist, because the determinant is non-zero.
Oh, okay, never mind. Okay, yeah. Can I ask one last question?
Yeah.
So when we say that the diffeomorphism,
mm-hmm.
as real, we're thinking of them as real.
Exactly.
Does that mean we've made some choice? Because twister space is a complex manifold.
Exactly.
Complex manifold. Is there some choice involved in reducing them to a real map?
No, every complex manifold is a real manifold is just one. What the transition functions are, smooth. But a complex manifold, you have a stronger constraint on the transition functions. They satisfy this PDE, this Cauchy-Riemann equation. So every complex manifold is a real manifold, but not conversely. But there is something non-trivial here because we can ask, what are the holomorphic coordinates here? And that's not entirely obvious in this presentation. But maybe I can say a little bit about that. So if we fix Z in CP1, then V1, V2 are coordinates on copy of C2, and this map gives an isomorphism R4 to C2. And the isomorphism is explicitly given by that expression up there. So what does that mean? Each point here picks out what's called a complex structure on R4. So that is each Z gives a complex structure on R4. Where in this complex structure, and to give a complex structure, you need to tell me what are the holomorphic functions. So the holomorphic functions are V1 A plus B Z, and V2 is minus B bar plus A bar Z. So, for instance, I realize the conventions I've ended up with are slightly funny, but that's okay. If I take Z equals 0, then A, B bar are holomorphic. So that's one natural choice. A spans one plane. I say, well, I'll just make A the holomorphic function. And B spans another plane. I'll make B bar the holomorphic function. And Z equals infinity, we find the holomorphic functions are B and A bar. So in the middle, some other combinations are the holomorphic functions. So the reason I wanted to mention this is that the collection of all ways of giving R4 a complex structure turns out to be the two-sphere. over 4 is equal to, well, you know, the OR4 has symmetry group SO4, but once I've chosen a complex structure, I break that to U2. So all complex structures are that, you know, I can get from one complex structure to any other by applying an element of SO4, or sometimes I don't change the complex structure. That happens if I apply a matrix which is in U2. So this turns out to be the coset SO4 modulo U2, because this is the symmetries of a given complex structure. And well, this is a 6-dimensional group. This is a 4-dimensional group. And you can convince yourself that this is actually the 2-sphere. So in other words, the meaning of the coordinate set is that it parameterizes exactly a choice of complex structure on OR4. And we come to the following conclusion. The twister space can be written as a point x in OR4 and a complex structure on the tangent space. Again, perhaps this is the most geometric way of thinking about it.
Can you repeat, I think that the part that I don't understand correctly is how every set gives the complex structure. Like, what are we calling complex structure? Like, how do I, like, holomorphic functions are V1 are V and V2, or mm-hmm. functions of them, or like that?
Yeah, exactly. The ring of holomorphic functions is generated by V1 and V2. So there's several, I suppose I should have written down in a more formal way what it means to give a complex structure. So one way is we give a map of real vector spaces from OR4 to C2. And we say two such things are the same if they're related by kind of a complex coordinate change here. So this isomorphism is some matrix in SO4. And the equivalence class is a matrix in U2, because those are the ones which preserve the complex structure. So that's how we get that. So the more slightly more formal way to say what a complex structure is, so a complex structure on a vector space, real vector space, is a map J, say J is in SOV, with J squared equals minus 1. So of course, you know, this is what we have when we have complex numbers. Why is this? A real vector space I can multiply by real scalars. Complex vector space I can also multiply by complex scalars. So I need a matrix which tells me how to multiply by complex scalars. And then some algebra tells you that the set of such things can be written as this coset.
Yeah. I'm misunderstanding. I'm not catching why U2 leaves the complex structure invariant. It's because it acts on J, for example, in this particular.
Yeah, it commutes with J.
Okay.
So if I have a matrix, you know, if I have a unitary matrix, it acts, V1, V2, it acts in a complex linear way. It doesn't involve any V bars. Whereas if I took a general matrix in SO4 and I thought about how it acted on V1 and V2, it might involve V bars. So a unitary matrix, if I multiply both things by I, I can bring the I out. That means it commutes with J.
So normally when I think of complex structures, I think, okay, some charts that are holomorphic, but now we have a vector space which has a lot more structure and we're somehow leveraging that, I feel. So on top of that, you mentioned SO4, so there's also inner products in both spaces. So for some reason, studying the complex... So for instance, if I have two inner complex structures, they're not going to be holomorphic to one another. Is that would be the claim that they're different, right? They're not...
Yeah, like, so even on... Like if I take C, you can choose a complex structure with... Or 2, you can choose a complex structure where your holomorphic function is x plus iy, and I might choose one where it's x minus iy.
Okay. And those would be different complex structures.
They're different complex structures. Because one of them, you know, in... In two dimensions, what's this matrix J? Well, it's some orthogonal matrix which squares to minus 1. So there's two choices. I go rotate anti-clockwise by 90 degrees, or I can rotate clockwise by 90 degrees. And these give rise to the two complex structures, where the holomorphic functions are x plus iy. You get a plus, because I take x and I rotate it by 90 degrees, I get y. So that's why it's x plus iy. And the minus is because if I rotate it the other way, I get minus y.
And what prevents them from being holomorphic to one another? Why can't I? What am I thinking about? There seems to be a complex conjugation there, but well, okay. Yeah,
well, you can do some change of coordinates, but just the function z and the function z bar are just not the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Somehow.
So in the 2D case, we only can choose like to use I or minus I.
Yes.
But in the 4D case, here we say that every different set.
Yeah, because in the 2D case, I have a matrix in SO2. And SO2 is a one-dimensional group, and this matrix squares to minus 1. There's two possibilities. But in the 4D case, this is a six-dimensional group. There's many more possibilities. So. Yeah.
Is there a reason why we'd say the complex structure is on a tangent space rather than just on one?
I said it like this because you might want to try to generalize this to some other manifold. So if I give you some other space-time, this is how you define twister space for that space-time.
You said something like this is saying that the isomorphism is SO4 while the equivalence class is U2. I don't understand the statement that the isomorphism is SO4.
Yeah, sorry, I said that too fast, so I'll... So let's give a coordinates x1 to x4. And I'm going to take a standard complex structure, J0, where J0 of, say, dx1 is dx2, J0 dx2 is minus dx1. So this initial complex structure is just on each plane, the x1, x2 plane, I rotate by 90 degrees clockwise. The x3, x4 plane, I rotate by 90 degrees clockwise. So it's kind of some block diagonal matrix. So you can show that any other J with J squared equals minus 1 is A J naught A transpose for A in SO4. So any other one is conjugate to this one. So the set of such things has an action of the group SO4 by conjugation. So you can check that this also squares to minus 1, because I'll get A, J, A transpose, and the A's in the middle cancel out. The J's become minus 1, and the A's at the end cancel out. However, sometimes this is equal to J naught. Not if and only if A is actually unitary. The unitary matrices are characterized by this fact that they can commute with that. So that tells us the set of complex structures is SO4 mod U2.
Yes. Just to clarify, so we're saying the space of complex structure somehow is equivalent to counting the number of J's we have, where J is something analogous to multiplying by I.
Mm-hmm.
All the ways in which you can multiply by I is... Well, yeah, it's S4 modulo, those things that are redundant, okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Somehow, okay, fair enough.
What will be the set of complex structures on Minkowski space?
You don't want to look at complex structures in Minkowski space in the same way, because if I look in Minkowski, let's look in the two-dimensional space. In 2D, so in Euclidean signature, I could take a vector like our covector dx1 plus I dx2, j of this, well, this becomes x2, this becomes minus x1. So this is the eigenvalue for I. The reason for writing this down, so this is, you know, this is like dz. So dz and dz bar are the eigenvalues of j. But now if I go to Lorentzian signature, dz and dz bar become real. So if we Wick rotate, so x2 becomes I times time, dz, dz bar become, say, like null dx minus. These are null and real. So
this is light cone.
These are light cone coordinates, exactly. So when we Wick rotate, what was originally our holomorphic and anti-holomorphic coordinates become light cone coordinates. So the whole notion of complex structure doesn't really work anymore. In the 2D, the analog of choosing a complex structure is you choose this light ray or you choose that light ray. Those are the two complex structures. So in 4D, I don't really have a very clear picture of it, but it's not going to be so simple.
I'm sorry, go.
I just have a quick question. When we have SO4 mod U2, it looks like we're taking equivalence classes of SO4, and then we can take representative J, but how do we know that the representative squares to minus 1?
Oh. How do I know that this expression squares to minus 1?
Just that J squared is minus 1. Like, if we choose any element of SO4, it might not necessarily square to minus 1.
What? If I take it, so what I'm doing is my new j is this expression here. It's given by taking my initial j and multiplying and conjugating by my SO4 matrix. And this expression automatically squares to minus 1.
But I think maybe my question is, why is the set of complex structures so big to be all of SO4 mod U2? Because I could choose an element of SO4 that was.
Right. No, I see what you're saying, but I want to associate a complex structure to an element of SO4, and you're thinking the complex structure is just this matrix. And you're right, that doesn't work, because this matrix may not square to minus 1. But that's not what I'm doing. I'm saying the complex structure is this matrix. And this matrix does square to minus 1, because the A's and A transposes cancel.
Okay, thank you. I think I copied it wrong.
So we have this picture that Twister space is complex structures on R4.
Yes.
But the thing that I don't understand is it's the complex structure on the tangent space of R4.
Yes.
Not R4 itself.
Uh-huh.
And if we consider a generic, that's not R4, a generic manifold.
Well, if I take a generic manifold, the tangent space at each point does look just like R4. So. So if I was to, you know, it doesn't have a canonical basis, but suppose I chose a frame at that point, then it will become R4, and then my set of complex structures would be a copy of S2. For a generic manifold, though, that copy of S, because you might not be able to choose a global frame field if it's some complicated manifold, that copy of S2 might not be. Be a trivial bundle, it's a non-trivial bundle of S2s.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, so we spent a lot of time explaining what Twister space is, but I wanted to get to explaining what is it good for. The Penrose transform says that Dalbeau or Czech cohomology of Twister space. Is going to be equal to some solutions of field equations on R4. So to explain this correspondence, I need to explain a little bit about these cohomology groups. So I'll explain a bit about Dalbeau cohomology. Oh, sorry, wrong one. If I have a complex manifold, omega 0 q of x is going to be the tensors which look locally like sum f I 1 I q d z bar I 1 So I know you guys should have some familiarity with the Durham complex. So this is really similar. Omega 0 q of x is a subspace of omega q of x, the space of k forms, so q forms, with complex coefficients. Such that in a local patch, we only have DZ bars. So it's just the same definition. on a complex manifold, on a real manifold, locally, we have dx's, and that's a collection of independent covectors. On a complex manifold, dz and dz bar form a basis. And I want to look at things built only from the dz bars. So there's a map. D bar. Given by basically the same formula as the Durham operator. Now, in our discussions, we're mostly going to be talking about omega 0, 0 and omega 0, 1, maybe sometimes omega 0, 2. So, sometimes there can be confusing signs. They're not going to be that important for what we'll be talking about. So, turns out the composition composition is zero. And the Dalbach homology maybe I can write like this: HP bar of X is the kernel of D bar is Q. Okay, so again, everything is so similar to the Durham complex, except with this thing that we don't use DZs at any point. So let's compute some examples. On C to the N, the set of elements in H0 if it's in H0, the convention is, when I have a minus 1 here, the convention is I set that to 0. So for things in the 0th double cohomology, we only are looking at things in the kernel of D bar. We don't worry about the image. That doesn't do anything. So these are just functions such that sum dz bar I df dz bar I equals 0. And now, these dz bars, they're all linearly independent. So if this equation holds, then all of these coefficients must vanish. This argument applies in general. The 0th Dalbo cohomology is always just the holomorphic functions. Any questions so far? All right.
Maybe how should one interpret that in the sense of, for instance, in the rank cohomology, for some reason I associate zero cohomology with connected components.
Absolutely.
And how is that encoded in here?
Well, zeroth rank cohomology is about functions. When I differentiate in every direction, I get zero. That means they're constant on every connected component. And here it's functions when I differentiate in certain directions, they're zero.
Okay. And does this one also contain topological information like that or no?
If I had a compact manifold, then like the maximum principle tells me any holomorphic function on a compact manifold is constant. Or at least locally constant. So if it was a compact manifold,
it would tell the number.
Tell them of components, exactly.
Okay.
Let's see. It's also possible to talk about the Dalbo complex with coefficients in some kind of holomorphic tensor. For example, omega 0 q, x, tx is the tangent bundle. These are things locally like fi dz bar I, fi comma I, del z I. The cotangent bundle, this would be the same. This should be an upper index, sorry. And the formulas we gave for the double operator are just the same. So we can define just in exactly the same way. So I wanted to introduce this because we'll need these generalizations when we talk about twister space. So this is all a little abstract. So here are some theorems about how you can compute double cohomology.
Can I ask a little question?
Yeah.
Am I supposed to think of Tx as a tensor field? Is that a thing?
Yeah. Well, it's a vector field, which only involves dz's and not dz bars. So in particular, it's a tensor field of a particular type. And remember, we had this discussion where on a complex manifold, you know, you can decompose your tensor fields further by looking at how many dz's and dz bars you have. So theorem, firstly, on C to the n, H Q X with coefficients in any tensor bundle really anything at all is equal to 0 for Q greater than 0. And H 0 is the holomorphic tensors. The second part we already knew. The first part is actually not obvious. You can look up a proof in some book if you want to. So the second part is, suppose X is U union V, where U and V are both copies of Cn. So this is going to be good because twister space is like this. It's a union of two opens. Then HQX coefficients in anything. Any holomorphic tensor bundle is equal to 0 for Q bigger than 1. So of course, you can presumably see what happens if I had 3 opens, each of which looked like Cn. It would be bigger than 2. And we can also describe this. Thank you. So what is it? H q of x. Say h1 of x with coefficients in whatever my tensor bundle is. Is equal to the quotient holomorphic tensors on U intersection V divided by those tensors which extend without poles to U, R, to V. Okay, so this is super concrete, and if you don't mind, I'll just take a quick minute to write down what happens for CP1. Is U union V, where U is the set Z is not equal to infinity, V is the set Z is not equal to 0. So what is H1 double of CP1 with coefficients in the cotangent bundle? Well, let's take this definition. We look at, well, U intersection V is the locus where Z is neither 0 nor infinity. So holomorphic tensors here are Z to the n dz, where n is an integer. So this extends across 0 if n is at least 0. If n is negative, of course, that has a pole at 0. So we're removing the ones which extend across 0 without poles, so we can get rid of z to the n dz for n, any non-negative thing. But let's think about it. When does it extend across infinity? Well, dz has a second order pole at infinity. So we need z minus 2 dz extends across infinity. Extends across infinity if n is minus 2 or less. So we conclude that the Albo cohomology group is equal to C with basis z inverse dz. OK, and then so what will happen is, like, we do the same game on twister space, and we'll find miraculously this vector space will be the solutions of the Young-Mills equation or something. OK, any questions?
Where does the condition on extension come from?
Let's see. Yeah, there's some slightly complicated translation between here and the other picture, which I'm trying to remember. So if I have one of these guys, you multiply it by some kind of standard 0, 1 form, Maybe like a delta function in the intersection. Yeah, that's it. If I had something in here, then you would look at z to the n dz times the delta function where z equals 1. This is a 0-1 form, because delta function on something codimension 1 is naturally a 1 form. And then this could be d bar of z to the n dz delta function z less than or equal to 1 if this is positive. If this was negative, the d bar applied to something with the pole picks up a delta function, which we'll discuss later. But so this is roughly why it works.
I have two questions. So the twister space that we defined was the intersection of U and V, where U and V were individually C3 and not the union.
No, but the twister space was the union. Yeah.
So related to that, the second theorem here is very restrictive in the sense that for any q greater than 1, the Dolbach cohomology will be 0.
Mm-hmm.
But functions are homogeneous, like minus 2 is minus 2 in N. So this restriction will send them all to 0.
No, the restriction is not... So the way I'm doing it, like this homogeneity you mentioned, is encoded in which tensor bundle? So the fact that the second Dolbach cohomology vanishes, that's kind of unrelated to the homogeneity.
So that will be equivalent to saying that it satisfies the equation of function in some sense.
Yes, like, you know, for example, H1 of twister space with the trivial tensor bundle, yeah, those will be certain solutions of Maxwell's equation.
So for the union of two, there's also an identification, right? So it's not only a union, but it's a union with a specific identification, I suppose?
Yeah, that's right. I mean...
And that's related to the modding out, or no? Because it did...
Yeah, the modding out needs that identification, exactly.
Okay. And why is the space in the intersection, why is the space of holomorphic forms Zn?
Just because every holomorphic function has a Lorentz expansion.
So exactly, I was thinking the exponential. Okay, so
you can expand it. You can expand it. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
And then we remove those that can be extended. Okay.